Accession number 20596, Reel 5.
Mr. Somerset, Reel 5.
And I see, I was very fit. And I remember one of my companions was a chap called Godfrey Freeman, who'd been a glider pilot at Arnhem, and he'd been captured and escaped, and he suffered in the same way as I did, was that he felt well, but nobody seemed to want his services. You see, the Herefords had been disbanded, the North Staffords had been broken up to provide reinforcements for other units. I hadn't got a regiment. There was no one wanted me. And all this time, battles were going on, and I felt I'd been sort of out first ball, really, and I wanted another innings, and no one was prepared to offer me one. Nobody wanted one. And during this time, the British government was telling the Americans that they were scraping the bottom of the barrel and so on and so forth, and they hadn't any more reinforcements left. And all this time, wounded officers sort of longing to go back. Well, eventually, I think in February, I was recalled, and I went to Northern Ireland to the 8th Battalion of the Manchester Regiment. They had a curious history. All the other Manchester battalions were machine gun and mortar battalions. That's heavy machine gun, or medium machine gun mortar battalions. But the 8th Manchester was a TA infantry battalion, the Manchesters. They'd spent most of the war in mortar, done a few months in Italy, and then their Python tour was up, and so they came home. And so virtually got, we had two messes in effect. We had a subaltern's mess, which was full of sort of retreads from Normandy, like myself, and a senior officer's mess, which consisted of those who'd done their Python tour and were not going to go overseas again. They were much older, and those who weren't married were all sort of looking for wives, that kind of thing. The idea was that we were training ex-coast gunners as infantry for the Far East. That was the idea, because coastal artillery was no longer needed, because all risks of invasion and so on were over. Well, then, from Northern Ireland, we went down, continued our training down in Pembrokeshire at Angle, the south side of that huge, I'm trying to think what that's huge.
Milford Haven,
that's right, the great inlet there. And while we were there, the atom bombs were dropped, and so there was no need to train for the Far East. So we went home on leave, and the next thing was posted to the Royal Irish Fusiliers, and off to the Middle East to relieve those who'd been there for years and years and years.
Which number battalion was that?
It was called the 2nd Battalion. But, again, they had a strange history. The 2nd Battalion, as their name implies, was a regular battalion. They had spent, like the Manchesters, a lot of time in Malta and had then been involved in that abortive and unsatisfactory attempt to capture Kos and Leros in the autumn of 44, I suppose it was.
43,
was it? And, you know, when we thought, yes, it must have been 43, yes, when it was thought that the Germans would be pulling out of the Dodecanese in Greece and so on. And most of the battalion got put in the bag. So they were trying to recreate a 2nd Battalion. We had two officers from the real 2nd Battalion, ex-POWs. The other Fog officers were from some other battalion of the Fogs who'd been with, I think it was 78 Div in Italy. Anyway, we're a fairly mixed bunch, and the men likewise. We had one battalion, one company of real Irishmen, quite a proportion of whom came from what my parents would call the Free State, and were told that when they went home at the end of the war, that they would lose civil rights in Ireland because they had joined, I have to be careful here, I think their real crime was that they deserted from the Irish army, which they knew wasn't going to fight, in order to join the British army, which they knew was going to fight. Anyway, poor dears, we had to try and look after them. Then we had one company of the King Leopold and two companies of the Cameronians. It was a pretty strange assortment, and not a very happy battalion. And the officers were all sorts. And when we got to Alexandria, we were garrison battalion, Alex, really nothing very much for us to do. And so the regular officers of the Royal Irish Fusiliers set us the job of learning to the manoeuvres, the drill manoeuvres, required a troop the colour. Well, you know, for people wanting to get back to civilian life, this really was, this real soldiering, as they called it, was a bit the limit, a bit beyond the limit. I don't know if you ever, have you ever watched Trooping of the Colour? Well, I believe one of the manoeuvres is wheeling in line a whole company, 120 men. Well, of course, this is an extremely skilled manoeuvre, but to expect people at the end of a war to get very interested in that, no, I think you've got to be a professional soldier to appreciate that sort of thing. I was quite happy when the Irish Fusiliers sent me off to on a course up in Haifa. It was what was it called? The Army? Anyway, it was a sort of educational course. The Army felt that if soldiers weren't going to fight anymore, that they might occupy their time by discussing current affairs and that sort of thing. So off I went to
this course. Not the Army Bureau of Current Affairs.
That's it. That's right. The Army. Well, this school. That's right. Nicknamed the Army School of Carnal Knowledge in Mount Carmel College. That's right. In Haifa, and I went up, that was quite fun, actually. One of our instructors was a chap called Hugh Weldon, who subsequently became sort of director of television at the BBC. I remember Hugh. And at the end of that, Hugh and I went up to the Cedars. The Cedars had been a school of mounted warfare, and we went up there and skied. It sort of kept going as an army sort of holiday camp. And then on my way home, there's a very nice officers' club in Beirut, and I went over and had a look at Baalbek. And then on my way home, I pitched up with some 6th Airborne, and we went and had a look at Damascus, where we were still occupying Syria at that time, because the Syrians wanted us to stay until the French had gone. They were very keen to see the French off, and then back to Haifa from round the back of Mount Hermon. Well, then back to Alexandria, and it was getting hotter and hotter. Well, then the infantry were required to produce officers for the RASC, because the RASC tended to be, their officers tended to be older and therefore due for demobilisation earlier than we young infantry officers. I was 21. And the regiment was happy to be rid of me, packed me off to a school at Ismailia to teach me about what the RASC should do. So that was all right. There we go. I finished up after that at a place called 64DID, or whatever that stands for. Anyway, it was an RAF, an RASC depot down at Suez that issued rations to units in the Suez Canal and units passing through. It was actually quite interesting. At that time, we had a huge garrison on the Suez Canal, and of course, I think a couple of divisions up in Palestine, because things were getting increasingly difficult there. '64 DID, we had about 20 British, I suppose, 20 Celanese. They were very, I liked the Celanese. Was their funny way. Have you met Celanese in
India?
Their lovely way of talking. They can't. They haven't got a V in the thing. So it was always vegetable for the convalescent depot and so on. There's something I remember. Sergeant Widgie Wickrama. Widgie. Yes. Only Celanese in the depot is Singhalese, except ceremony. He is a hermit. Yes, remember that. Then the actual labour for shifting things was Arabs, and they were recruited from Upper Egypt. Some of them were one-eyed, and I inquired why they were one-eyed, and the reason was that if you had only one eye, you could avoid conscription into the Egyptian army. The normal way of avoiding conscription is the Egyptian army for the middle classes was you simply paid and that kept you out. But for the poor, in order to stay out of the army, you might have to put out one of your eyes. It was so unpopular that it was worth putting out one of your eyes in order to not be conscripted into the Egyptian army. Then we were guarded. People used to raid RASC and other camps. And so we had what were called good Germans to guard our camps at night, which they did with sort of pick holes. And so far as I know, complete success. But there were big camps that were raided, much, much bigger camps. And it was reckoned that the people directing the raiding forces were very possibly escaped German prisoners of war. The Italian prisoners of war didn't wish to escape. They used to make tunnels out of their camps, but the object of the tunnel was not so that they could get out, but so that they could get women in, or so it was said. It was a curious sort of. It was a horse transport unit belonging to the RASC. We used to go and ride their ponies. Well, while I was there, September 1946, my father died, and so I got compassionate leave, came home, and was at last posted the King's Shropshire Light Infantry. Spent the last month of my service in the barracks at Copthorne. Realised what a nice lot the shop. They're very nice. Shrewsbury's a very nice place, or was then, and Shropshire's a very nice lot, but I'd never sort of met them before. The only, my only recollection of military duty up there was I was sent up to Shrewsbury School to examine boys in for a thing in the OTC in those days called Cert A, which I'd taken when I was at Marlborough. And it was a small squad of boys, and the chap who had to pass Cert A, he was drilling these boys, and I observed that when he gave the command slope arms, one boy finished up with his rifle on his right shoulder instead of his left. So I said to this boy, I think it was Stevenson or something, Stevenson, I don't know if you've noticed, but it, number four finished up with his rifle on his right shoulder, and he ought to be on his left, you see. So you've got to, you're in charge, you've got to do something about it. So he stepped forward in the politest way. He said, I say to Selincourt, that was a jolly rotten slope. So I reckon that he was obviously officer material and passed him straight away. But, I formed a very good impression of Shrewsbury School on the strength of that. Actually, a lot of our officers at KSLI were Salopians. And so home, end of war. And then I went up that January, I went up to Oxford. I had actually matriculated while I was on leave in January 1945, because I got so bored on leave. My father said, well, why don't you go up? I had a place at Exeter, and so I, which was my father's old college, and so I'd no sooner started that term than I was recalled to the army, but I was being so bored with being on leave.
So you started at Exeter College, Oxford?
In spring Hillary term of 1947. But I had actually matriculated 2 years before while I was on leave. See, I had this, after I'd been wounded, I had this everlasting leave. My father was right. He said when I came home in October, he said, why don't you keep a term now? And I said, oh no, the army will soon want me back. Well, he was absolutely right, they didn't.
So did you do 3 years at Oxford?
I did eight terms. A lot of people only did 2 years because, of course, there was a great backlog from the war. Well, for obvious reasons. I mean, the people hadn't... I mean, some of my colleagues at Exeter, chaps who'd been up in 1939, they were about... I was about 20... What was I, 20... I was 23, but I mean, the other chaps were 27, you know, that sort of thing.
So how did you come to be in the colonial service?
Well, after Oxford, the normal entry to colonial service was either Oxford or Cambridge in the old days before the war. After Oxford, I did a colonial service course in London. From 49 to 50, and then I went out to Eastern Nigeria. Our colonial service course in London wasn't very well organised because it was the first one. Prior to that, all colonial service courses had always been an extra year either at Oxford or at Cambridge. But they thought that London was somehow more democratic, and that so those going to Eastern and Western Nigeria went to London, was the Northerners, of course very conservative, went to Oxford and Cambridge and did the colonial service course there. The colonial service courses in Oxford and Cambridge were sort of well organised because, I mean, they'd been running for 25 years, ever since the First War. But the London one only started in 1949, so the first year was not very fully occupied. As far as I remember, we started work on Tuesday afternoon and broke off on Thursday evening or something like that. It wasn't too arduous.
Which college was this?
This was at London. That's a good question. We used to go to some lectures at UCS, some at the LSE, some at King's. You know, we used to sort of, wherever the lectures were required. Some of them, of course, for languages, we went to the School of Oriental and African Studies. When we turned up, nobody knew where the LSE, do you know where the LSE is?
Yes.
In Houghton Street? Well, nobody knew where the LSE was. So the natural thing to do is get a taxi. Some of the taxi drivers are a bit hazy about where Houghton Street was. Anyway, the first day we were supposed to turn up at these LSE, half a dozen taxis turned out, and these people came up. And the porter at the LSE came to me and said, "Sir, who are all these gentlemen turning up?" And I said, "Well, I think most of them look to me as if they're Colonial Service cadets." And I said, "The reason they've arrived in taxis, not because they're terribly rich, but because it's the only way of finding out where this place is." And the other occupants of the London School of Economics naturally immediately nicknamed us with the White Masters. So off we went, and then after that we had a nice little outing in the summer. We went up to Pembroke, Cambridge for some sort of Colonial Service conference. And then we sailed that autumn, around about this time of year, in the MV Accra, an Elder Dempster from Liverpool, calling in at the Canaries, I think Las Palmas. We called in at Freetown. In those days, you couldn't, not a ship of that size, couldn't tie in at Freetown. You went ashore on the King Tom. It was the little sort of ferry that ran you ashore. Freetown has a very heavy rainfall. And the gutters... in those days, certainly, was so deep that they have, as it were, to be protected. The pavement overlaps the gutter. So if you can imagine, the camber takes the water off the road, but it doesn't just go into a gutter. There's a deep trench underneath the pavement in order to contain the water. But I think the rainfall is probably something like 150 inches a year. Sierra Leone takes that summer rain right on the nose because it's right on the point. I was subsequently down in Brass, which again on the bites of Benin and Biafra. That had a heavy rainfall, about 140 inches of rain a year. And then I think we called in, whether we went ashore at Takoradi or not. Anyway, we didn't. I know by then the exciting business of going ashore on the Gold Coast, you know, they used to go ashore in canoes with crew boys, that had ceased. And then we finished up at Lagos, which I suppose was probably the end of the road for that boat.
Did you know where you were bound for?
Well, I knew I was going to the east, but I didn't know where I would go in the east. I stayed with an Easterner in Lagos, someone who was in the Secretariat, a chap called Acton. And after a couple of days, we met the governor, McPherson, and we attended the House of Assembly and heard Ezekiwe and Hugh Foote sort of
arguing with each other. Arguing with each other.
Well, yes, I think Hugh Foote was the chief secretary, and Ezekiwe was one of the sort of African politicians who was Easterner, who was all for self-government and so on. We took the train, and in order to get to eastern Nigeria by train, you've got to go up to Kaduna and down a great sort of hook-shaped journey. And I don't think I'm exaggerating, but I think the train was a day late at Enugu. So I think the journey, I think it took 4 days instead of three, or 3 days instead of two, I can't remember. It was a very long journey. And there we met Freddie Kay, the chief secretary, and we went out. I went out to my station, which was Orca, which is about halfway between Enugu and Anitra, in a lovely old wagon. It was a 1924 lorry belonging to Government House. I'm trying to think what the make of it. It was marvellous how it kept going.
What was to be your first job?
Well, I was to understudy. I was what's called a cadet to the district officer, a chap called Andy Gerard.
Which district?
Orca, which was in the Anitra province. All the divisions in eastern Nigeria are relatively small compared with northern Nigeria. I mean, latterly I was in charge of the smallest division, which was Ogoni, which was only 450 square miles, and I was also at another time in charge of Brass, which I think was the biggest, and I think Brass was about 2,000 and 3,000 square miles. Brass was, communications were very difficult in Brass because they're virtually all by water. The fastest thing you could get on Brass was a bicycle. There was no motor transport in Brass. It's all Niger Delta. Near the sea, it's mangrove swamp and sort of freshwater swamp inland. They have built a road into the northern part of Brass at Yenagoa, I think, now. That's certainly a possibility, but to build a road to Brass itself would be, even nowadays, I think, would be hideously expensive. But apart from anything else, that southern part of Nigeria, there's no stone. Some of the concrete work is quite extraordinary. The hardest things available were the kernels of the oil palm nut. Well, I suppose they are the nut of the thing. And when the kernel had been cracked to get the oil out of it, these cracked bits were used as aggregate, which seems extraordinary, but that was the hardest thing available. The other hard thing available, it being a country where Europeans have been for some hundreds of years, would have been broken bottles. But the trouble with broken bottles, they've got a sort of shiny surface which doesn't take kindly to concrete. it's a difficult, it's not an easy territory in which to make permanent things. My house in Brass and the ADO's house were both put up in the 1890s when Brass was a vice consulate, before the days of colonialism, you know, when it was the Oil Rivers Protectorate, I suppose, or the Niger Coast, one of those two protectorates.